Welcome. Another edition of In Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis. Continuing the explorations of the cultures of consciousness. Right now I can hear a distant lawnmower, a little bit of crackle over the headphones that connect me to Skype, a slight grumble just in my belly, and a sort of cool hiss of the wind through the trees. These ambient sounds surround us all the time, and we don't really tap into them, the kind of music and more than music that the world is constantly bringing before us. And I have to say that one of the great satisfactions I take in life is the very simple process sometimes of simply tuning into the ambient soundscape that surrounds me, listening to it partly as music, partly as a way of relating to environment, and partly as a way of tuning in to a quality of sensation that, while it does involve a lot of concepts, you know, I name things, stomach rumble, lawnmower, there's also a freshness and an immediacy to sound that I find more intimate and sometimes way more clarifying than the similar immediacy of vision. And we'll be talking about sound and music, ambient landscapes, recordings, the internet, with our guest today, Mark Wiedenbaum. He's the maestro behind Disquiet.com, which is an amazing multidimensional website that's been going for a very long time and devoted to music, electronic music, soundscapes, new ways of thinking about and constructing, composing music, understanding how sound and music play themselves out in our digital lives. And so I look forward to that conversation very much. Before we bring Mark on, I'd like to invite on our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Daoud. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Eric.
So one of the things we're going to talk to Mark about is about dreaming in one record by Aphex Twin, Selected Ambient Works, Volume 2, which he's recently written a book about. And I was noticing that you're doing an event this Friday where they also talk about, let's see, a hypnagogic state will be induced during the evening at this invocation event that you're appearing on Friday.
They're totally going to be doing that, dude. They're going to be using sound, like you said, in very much that technique. It's so, again, synchronistically, things and events line up. It's so funny because what you were saying about experiencing that listening and kind of trying to zoom in on those ambient sounds. There's so many books about the third eye and opening your third eye and doing all of those kind of techniques, but no one ever talks about your third ear. In my experience, I feel like there is a third ear and you participate with it by doing things like you were talking about, experiencing those things and those you know, techno music and a lot of the electronic music, and that's some of the themes that are going to be investigated on Friday night by using some of those, you know, third ear techniques. You can, in fact, induce certain states.
Yeah, so tell me more about the event. It's called The Invocation, and there's some, like, this is by being put on by a society that's usually underground, but they're popping their heads up into the limelight for this one event that you're also speaking at. So what's the story?
Yeah, the group does a lot of really cool stuff. They are underground, like you mentioned. They kind of remind me a lot of, you know, early Cacophony Society or, you know, that same situationist type of idea, which I like a lot. So they're going to be doing this event that they're opening to the public to engage in. I'm not really allowed to talk about it too much because it's supposed to be secret on purpose. But it will be inducing a state, as you mentioned earlier, for the purpose of revealing a big illusion, which there is going to be a magician there as well who'll be making a nice big magic trick for everybody. So it'll be pretty cool.
That sounds totally wonderful. People can find out more about it at atlasobscura.com under their events. And I also wanted to mention that they say, and I'm not going to be revealing anything, that that one of the elements of the evening will be ancient cocktails.
That sounds pretty
appealing. So with that, let's bring Mark onto the show. Mark, thanks for joining us on Expanding Minds.
Thanks very much for having me.
Yeah, it's great. So listen, I want to before we talk about your book, I want to talk about Disquiet. I mean, it's been a really amazing project, a long running, a lot of energy into it. It's changed and transformed and bloomed, and it's maintained a very interesting, unique kind of insight or vision on what music means today in the 21st century. So I wanted just to see a little bit about like the origins of it. What were you thinking when you decided to start doing the site? How soon did it develop its own particular kind of perspective on the question of listening?
Sure. Well, it occurred at an important juncture in my life. After college, I moved to California from New York to take a job at a music publication that Tower Records used to produce called Pulse Magazine. And I was there for 7 years, and I thought I'd be there forever, though, of course, eventually Tower went out of business. But in 96, I was, I'd come to recognize something, which is that I really thought I'd had particularly big ears, as the phrase goes, which is to say you listen to lots of different things. But over time, I'd come to understand that I really enjoyed what at the time I thought of as electronically mediated sound, but over time I've really come to think of as technologically mediated sound. And if we have time, we can get to that distinction later on. But in any case, in 96, I took a job in San Francisco and moved down, and I'd had fledgling little web presences beforehand, but I'd never bought a proper URL. So at the end of 96, after moving to San Francisco, I purchased Disquiet.com, and initially it was just a place to post articles that I'd already printed elsewhere. And then over time, I'd get these emails from people saying, hey, when's the next article coming out? And my response was this complicated, well, as soon as I'm assigned one and it's been published, and then it's run its course, then there'll be another one online, because that's how it works. And then it occurred to me, wow, I guess I could just write things just for the site. And that was before the word blog had come to explain that sort of scenario.
Wow.
And in time, I did it more and more where that was just the primary place I wrote about music.
And so when did it start up?
I bought the URL at the end of 1996. But yeah. Before that, I'd had fledgling little sites on netcom.com and a couple of other Bay Area web hosts.
So when it came to naming the site, you named it Disquiet, and I know that that's partly largely in reference to the book of Disquiet by an author that both you and I love, Fernando Pessoa, an amazing Portuguese a figure and probably the supreme figure in Portuguese literature in the 20th century. What was it about him that has either inspired you personally but also made you think about that term or that ambiance when it came to your interest in electronic music?
Well, I really fell hard for the book of Disquiet. There was a review of it in the New York Times Book Review, a very tiny one that said it was the sort of thing that you would dip into over time, and that really appealed to me. I just picked it up on the strength of that one review. And I was confused because I didn't know exactly which copy to get because there were multiple copies. I think it had just entered the public domain, not the translations, but the original. And so there were all these translations popping up. And not only did I enjoy them individually, but I really enjoyed how these very strange descriptions of the world differed depending on who was translating them. And I have no ability with any language other than English, except maybe HTML. And so translation in foreign languages has always been very, especially mysterious to me. And I enjoyed not just the book itself and his very poetic vision of the world and his very poetic vision of the mundane everyday life and the beauty in it and the confusion and the mystery in it, but also just how that was even further confounded, and I mean confounded in a positive sense, by all these different translations that took different approaches to the very same phrases. So I did
that was very much my experience, because I think I probably picked it up around the same time, maybe even read the same review, and I was puzzled by these translations, and I found my way into it, and I ended up reading his poetry. And people, listeners who aren't familiar with Pessoa should also know that there, he has a very interesting esoteric dimension, that even though in many ways he was a writer of the mundane and the kind of both the despair and the wonder in quotidian life and quotidian existence and the question of the self, where is the self as I'm sitting here on a train going to work one more day, that at the same time he was fascinated and a deep student of esotericism, and he would create his different identities to write his poetry for him. So he had these multiple, sort of almost like multiple personalities, and he would draw up astrological charts for each one. And he was also a friend and correspondent of Aleister Crowley. So he's a very interesting figure for those of us who, walk this line between the esoteric and the more modern conditions, existential conditions of life today. So, it makes sense. And there's also something about this term disquiet as a way into the question of listening.
Yeah, its appeal was so self-evident to me at the time, and I remember conversing with various friends. You know, back then, the dictionary was wide open. All these words were available as domains, which seems silly in retrospect, but at the time, you could just pretty much turn to any page in the dictionary, and at least half those words were still available as a .com. And I had a handful of words that I was interested in, and no one I talked to who I got advice from had any hesitation about which one I should use. The way that it took the word quiet and turned it slightly on its head, and the way that it invoked a kind of discomfort, and got to the, in a way was sort of, it was a sort of almost redundant term, in that once you understand the word disquiet, suddenly the word quiet has that stain henceforth. I just found a lot of beauty in that. And it was very nice to have a little bit of a mantle, leaving Pulse especially, talking about identity. Leaving Pulse, I really felt like I was leaving a big chunk of my identity behind, and it felt really valuable to have a new identity. And disquiet.
Well, one of the things that shifted there as well is, at Pulse, when you have big ears, wide ears, and you're listening to all kinds of music, so you sort of moved on in your interest, and in many ways you left the song behind. I mean, I remember talking to you. We went out and saw a wonderful show, Saw Earth. And you were just kind of saying that, like, basically you just, the songs are really no longer a part of your life and haven't been for a long time. And, a lot of people listen to electronic music, but then they listen to Bob Dylan and they listen to this and that, da, 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 da. It's all this kind of music. But it seems to me you made a different kind of shift where it's like going, if you think about like song music and instrumental music or song music and electronic music, you kind of went to like electronic music or technologically mediated music and sound, like that point between music and sound. There's sort of like this shift away from the song. Why did you make, why did that happen spontaneously? What do you think, how was the appeal lost, and what did you see sort of being offered in this kind of shift of listening?
I really appreciate your description of that. That really registers with me as my experience of it. I think that, what I experienced over time was as much a matter of me being comfortable with what I was interested in as it was a matter of me becoming aware of what I was interested in. I think I spent a lot of time trying to understand what friends of mine enjoyed, and a lot of my early experience of music was listening to stuff my friends loved and being really intrigued by their enthusiasm and then listening for that. And sometimes I really got it, like in the case of The Jam, for example. The British band, and some times I just could not, for the life of me, figure out what was there. And that was fine, and it's great that my friends and I all had different tastes. But in time, I realized that a lot of the parts of music I really enjoyed was just that. It was parts. There were little segments of things. There was, like, transitions in classical music. For me in particular, a great example is the first 25 or 30 seconds of Mahler's First Symphony. To me, are just extremely beautiful, this just attenuated string section, and then the melody kicks in, and for me, bizarrely, I guess, I feel disappointment. I wanted music that had these transitional, that took these transitional states and stuck with them, and that really lingered in these transitional states, and that's the sort of sound I've ended up being intrigued by.
It's so funny you mentioned Mahler, man. It's like we're in, like, total sync here, because as soon as you started talking about, the first few moments, I was like, I've always had this experience with Mahler symphonies where, like, I'm cruising along, it's fine, I'm into it, it's exciting, and then there's, like, 30 seconds or something in the middle of somewhere where there's just this, like, tone, this space opened up where it's more about timbre than melody, it's more about a kind of environment than about a pulse, and it's like, and then almost sort of beginning to listen to those moments in other kinds of music. It's funny
it's so funny. That totally happened to me too, and I relate as well to those experiences. And I wonder if, because I would just think, doesn't everyone listen to music this way? But like you, Mark, I would my friends would give me this music that they were all into at the time. And I remember even as a teenager and before that, I would listen to the music they thought was acceptable. And when you listen to music and want to change it into something else, that's always an interesting reaction to it instead of being able to kind of flow along with where the person's going.
Yeah, there's sort of two ways the conversation can go, too. I mean, part of it's the stuff I'm interested in, and part of it's what I've come to think about the stuff I'm not interested in. Like, one of the interesting things on the pop music side is that I love singing pop music at home. I have a ukulele that I sing with I play with my daughter, and she's about 3 and a half. And I love having music in the home that way, and having her has definitely brought music back into my life in the traditional sense of music. But I still think in many ways, for me personally, pop music is something that's much more enjoyable for me to perform than it is to consume. The act of that repetition and the verse, chorus, verse structure is really rich to do in the home. But in terms of listening, I find it difficult actually often to be at concerts. The third time I hear a verse, chorus, verse, song, and everything's rhyming, I'm sort of almost go out of my head.
So what was it that was starting to intrigue you more? And particularly, I want to press you on the sort of this liminal zone, this in-between space between music and sound.
Well, I think that part of what got me was that I found music that did that. Part of it was music that was very conscious of the technology that made it. You know, I love interviewing musicians. It's one of my great pleasures, and I do it to this day, though I've expanded the people I interview to include coders and technologists and authors and so forth. But sound is still the central to all these things. Performance. I'm interviewing an artist later today who does a lot of interesting work with sound. And I think that one of the things that really struck me was people who were conscious of the way technology was shaping what they were doing. And during the more big ears phase where I was interviewing country musicians because I happen to like their music, or gospel musicians and so forth, I had this great interview with this country singer. She was calling from the studio, and I asked her about this particular song on her record. And I was like, you know, I'm confused by the chorus because it's you singing in the first person, but there's also this chorus in the literal sense. There's this group of voices behind you that are also you, and you're all singing I. Who's the first person in that part of the song? Which is, it's almost a stupid question to ask because it's just the way pop music is made. But I had to ask her the question because I thought her voice was beautiful and there was so much consciousness to the lyrics. And there was this pause on there in the phone. She said, oh, man, I'm in the studio now and I've got to go back in to record. As soon as this interview is done, I've got to go record the chorus for this other song I'm working on. And I'm just going to totally fumble it because you've totally messed up my head in terms of what I'm doing. and that's not, I swear that was not my intent, but to mess her up, but my intent was definitely to probe these things that we took for granted. The more I probed them, the more I found people who thought that way and made music that way, and then this whole world of sound opened up to me as an available listening.
That's hilarious. As for saying, I got to tell this story. It's relevant. I taught a class on technoculture, undergraduate class at UC Davis, and you know, basically the goal was to try to get a lot of people were in it for area requirements and stuff. They were not really there because they were particularly interested in technoculture. What I really wanted to do is sort of create the sense of criticality, of being aware of, again, just like you're talking about, the technological context that allows cultural expression and cultural events to happen and what happens when you pay attention to culture that's self-conscious about that process and playing with the technology as well as the music or the film. And so, you know, that was kind of one of my goals. And then one time this girl was very quiet in the class. She never talked. She came to my office hours, which hardly anybody did, so it was kind of bizarre. And she said, and she was very serious, and she talked about how she went to a concert with her friends. And I don't remember even if she said what it was, but it was just some pop band or whatever. And she said that as she was watching the concert, she became aware of like how the lights were operating and then how the smoke machine was going and how the beats were keyed to the changes of the light. And she said it was actually, the funny part was that she was kind of a little disappointed about it because she could see how her friends were just engaged in the moment and she was suddenly becoming aware of how it was constructed. And she wasn't exactly like, you know, that wasn't exactly liberating for her. And I felt
so
kind of bad. I was like,
pop music really does provide a good enlightenment tool because it's so repetitive and absurd. Like you say, it like breaks the spell and it forces you into disillusionment.
Well, that's one of the things about the your listening, Mark, that I feel very, that I admire a lot is that I can see the way that for you listening is really part of like a continual inquiry into what is art, what is technology, what is listening, and you know, just in your capacity to, you know, keep sustaining it is a really long time. But I mean, maybe it sounds is too kind of amorphous or new age a question, but can you talk a little bit about listening as a path, like listening as a way to move through life and all its confusions, listening as a way to find out where we are in this technological age?
Yeah, certainly. I welcome that question. I also teach a course. I teach a course at a local art school. I've been doing it since 2012, and it's about what I describe as the role of sound in the media landscape. And it's divided into three sections, and the first section is reintroducing the idea of listening. And we talk about the role of sound and the role and the transition from a written culture, an oral culture, to a written culture, and what that transition meant. And we do a lot of exercises where we explore the idea of listening and become conscious of it in a way that we'd previously taken for granted. And I think that there's a lot of ways to look at sound, and a lot of people who write about sound right now are very possessive and tribal about that particular sense, as if you sort of join team sound versus team tactile or team smell. I'm intrigued by sound, clearly. I don't think there's much doubt about that. But I'm really interested in the role that sound plays in the world at large. And so I'm really interested in the role of sound in film and the role of sound in art. And, you know, there's a lot of art that goes under this idea of sound art. But when I go to the museum, if there's a sound art section, I'm excited by that. But I'm just as interested as the sound of the slide projector in the film installation area as I am by the section that says sound art and tells me, oh, now you can pay attention to sound.
You know, yeah,
I'm long fascinated by how things are labeled in museums. You know, you go to see this. You know, you mentioned earlier this idea of sound versus. There was a mention early on about this versus sound versus vision. I'm really intrigued by this idea of clairaudience, because when you talk about clairvoyance, you understand that people are saying seeing the future in a kind of metaphoric sense. But when you say clairaudience, that clears it up in a weird way, because suddenly you're only hearing. What does clairaudience mean, and how does that reflect back on the idea of clairvoyance?
So, you know, I just got to play off your words here. You know, in esoteric or parapsychology, you know, clairvoyance is something that's when, you know, you're able to see somehow a distant place in real time. Sometimes it's also, there's a temporal dislocation as well. You know, remote viewing is a modern term for it. That's pretty cool or whatever. But clairaudience is also the ability to hear these sort of distant sounds. And I've never had any experiences like that. But what I have had is very interesting, is that some of my more profound altered states, when I've just been meditating or in trance or in hypnagogia, when I'm in between waking and sleeping, and that's something we're going to talk about a little bit later when we talk about Aphex Twin, often when I'm in these states, it's not a visual experience, but an auditory experience. And extraordinary things have happened on that level of listening that has almost the kind of, almost a paranormal quality, but it's not something, again, as Maja was pointing out, if you're interested in spiritual work or the New Age or anything like along those lines, everybody knows about the third eye. Everybody knows about the idea of seeing other visions. Inside the mind, outside the mind, in dream, it doesn't matter. But people pay very little attention to sound as a kind of delivery or sight of...
Well, and I've had total sight. Clairaudient experiences, like in front of groups of people, too. So, I mean, that in a couple of different ways. One of them is induced or triggered by specific sound meditations. You know, some of those dumb ones that are placed at, you know, whatever... 432, you know, hertz, or things that are done on purpose, I've experienced it. And also, literally where I hear information, like the most extreme was I did a seance, and I clairaudiently received the name of a person who this, you know, person, there were like 30 people that saw it as this chick. I know it's all whatever, everyone's going to get all upset to even talk about it, but it literally, the name was spoken into my ear. It was absolutely 100%. Clairaudient, where I heard it in my eardrum, like as clear as day. I don't know any other way to describe it. You know, those things are important and they do happen, and I don't understand why no one pays any attention to it.
Well,
Just a mark. I want the thing that that made me think about this is not so much about the mystery of sound on the in the sort of supernatural sense, but just the way that listening in the way that I've learned from hearing you talk about sound and music and how sound is used is also about a way of kind of understanding how technology kind of constructs our experience and perception of the world, but often very peripherally, often almost subliminally. Like it's a way, like turning on to sound and how sound works in environments is also teaches us how to open up our framework to take in the subliminal elements that are kind of making our experience happen. Does that make sense?
Oh yeah, there's a lot of sonic thought comes out of environmentalism. You know, the whole idea of a soundscape came largely out of R. Murray Schafer's work, who introduced this term, and it came out of largely his, even though he's a composer, out of his interest in the environment in Canada and what the sonic environment was and whether that should be retained. And there's a great American acoustic recorder named Gordon Hempton. There's a documentary about him called Soundtracker. It's very interesting. He tells a very clear anecdote which just has so much information packed into it, which is that he was out in the jungle recording sound, got very uncomfortable, packed up his equipment, and just left. Later on, when listening to it, he realized that quite clearly in the sound was the sound of a leopard or a tiger or something like that. And
wow.
He responded to it very instinctively. And I've had that happen to myself where I was about a year after my daughter was born, we were in the backyard just playing, and I just felt this really weird sense. And I recognized that I was hearing something that made me uncomfortable, and I just grabbed her and ran into the house. And she thought, of course, this was part of a game. We ran to the back window, and I looked out, and a swarm of bees, large enough to fill our admittedly very tiny backyard, came. I watched it come over the fence and fill the backyard.
Whoa.
Now, I've been told subsequently, I have several friends who keep bees, that is the state in which they are almost incapable of stinging you. It would have been quite possible to just walk through it. No, thank you. I was quite angry at that. The hum, I mean, as someone who listens to drones, I can say that the hum of those was both beautiful and frightening at the same time. And so I'm very intrigued by the way that we, for various reasons, culturally over time, have perhaps become a little bit desensitized to sound. And one of the beautiful things about listening is that you, and this becomes a kind of fait accompli about the whole not listening to pop music as much, the more you spend time listening, the less you need to listen to music because there's so much else out there.
I totally agree. It's the way of listening to a soundscape, and particularly the fact that if you're opening up to sound in your environment, it's not 360 degrees, because it's hard to locate sound sources that are directly behind you as accurately as you can in the sort of, you know, front and side range. But you do have this surround sound opportunity to, and it almost doesn't matter what's happening in that surround sound. If in the right state of listening, it has the same freshness, dynamics, and kind of complexity and play as any, you know, marvelous piece of music or intentional kind of soundscape. And it's very nourishing. It's very satisfying. And it seems to me that it's something that is, again, like so many human capacities, it's something that's completely free, completely marvelous, inside your own head, and also very much involved in the world, in your relationship to your environment. But it's something that's not really kind of brought attention to. Instead, there's all this attention on music, on pop music, on consuming, on buying, on repeating, on doing it again, on seeing it live, but not really live because it's kind of a repetition. I mean, from that larger environmental listening perspective, you know, popular music, which I still enjoy very much in some ways, but much less so than I used to, it becomes a much more kind of a very, very circumscribed little space.
Yeah, and when I think that, you know, I mentioned the jam earlier, and I did not have in mind what I'm about to say when I brought it up. It was just a reference to a band. I remember during college reading an article about someone I went to school with saying that was their favorite band. I was like, wow, someone I know's favorite band is a band I've never heard of. I better go listen to them. But when I think about the jam now, the song that to this day is one of my favorites is English Rose. And part of what I love about it is the way that they have the sound of the waves in it. I was really intrigued. And the moment in that song where it transitions from field recording to song, to me, is what I really, I mean, the melody is beautiful, the message is beautiful. But man, that transition point is what I want to hold on to. And there's tons of music out there being made by artists that explore that transition point.
Great. Well, we're going to talk about more about transition points and the particular artist, Aphex Twin, but we got to take a break here. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis and Maja Daou. We're talking with Mark Wiedenbaum about the soundscapes that surround. We'll be right back.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou here with the co-host Eric Davis, and we're speaking with Mark Wiedenbaum about listening today, so listen carefully. Before the break, you had mentioned the sound of the waves as the inclusion. I thought that was so interesting because, to me, nature has a big component. Like you mentioned, the guy heard the predator, you heard the bees. And in nature, I feel like that's one of the best places where we can kind of acclimatize to these sounds. Although certainly in the city, but like Eric said, like with the pop music city scene, this is the thing. I think in the cities, it's like light at night. And obviously in some places, you have to turn up your senses. But listen, there's nothing better to make your ears go than to be in the woods at night or out in the darkness, having your sight taken away and being forced to utilize those other senses. And of course, when there's that threat of survival, then it gets turned up an awful lot. But I think a lot of people who get into listening have had some kind of experience like that. Like for me, Eric said a lot of it was tones, and with the Mahler, how it was certain tones that you get caught up in. For me, of course, a lot of that was in the heavy metal, how I would get interested in that music, because they would spend that time to really like have that one guitar tone just go forever, like in Orion with Metallica. But I wonder if you, like in your experience of having those heightened states of listening that you can like get into, have you had ones through music that have put you into a similar state such as that, like with the bees or something comparable, like a kind of music you could think of that turned you on like that in that same sense?
I was interviewed for a radio show several years ago for a project I'd done, and they'd sent a professional sound editor to record me, and I was aware of the idea of a room tone at that point, but I had not experienced it personally in a technological sense. And this woman came in with all this equipment and said, okay, now be really quiet, we're going to do a room tone of your office so we can then remove it from the audio when we put it on the radio. And I sat there, and when she was done, I asked her for a copy of it. She thought that was really cool. No one had ever asked her for a copy of their room tone before. I have a copy of my office's sound from super high-end equipment.
I love that. That's wonderful. You know, we have like room tones in our brains too, because there's a carrier frequency for all of our sound waves.
Oh, yeah.
Sometimes in meditation, and it can be actually kind of annoying. You tune into it, and then you're like, oh, great. Here's that sound. It's kind of like tinnitus. Can I make it stop now? And you're like, well, so sometimes you can hear too much. Too well.
That psychological aspect of sound is really important to me, too, because I think that a lot of times when we think about sound, we can be a little too causal about it, Newtonian. And I'm really intrigued about the psychological context of it. One thing I've really focused on in recent years is the role of sound in film. And I had the opportunity last year to do sound design with a very talented composer for a documentary film. And so much of what we were trying to do was to use everyday sound in the film in a compositional way, but to do it to represent the point of view of whoever was on screen at the time, which is very different from thinking, oh, there should be a fan versus, oh, right now, should that fan be louder or quieter? Is the person in a nervous state more aware of that, of their, less in control of their senses and therefore more likely to be annoyed by a sound and things like that? That aspect is really fascinating for me.
Oh, that is remarkable. I hadn't even really thought about the, no, I guess I've had that experience before of like being aware of how sound, especially horror movies, are like really obvious examples where ambient noises will come in with certain kinds of a certain sort of presence. But again, it's that wonderful element where it's right on the edge of awareness, and you can kind of like if you're tuning into it as a technical listener, you can see what's being done. But for most people, it just sort of ambiently leads you into an emotional state. Well, I mean, I want to make sure that we talk about Aphex Twin, and particularly because we're talking about this sort of liminal zone, states of consciousness, and this remarkable record, Selected Ambient Works, Volume 2. I remember when it came out, and it rocked my world, and I listened to it in all sorts of different ways, even though it wasn't rock music. It was the opposite of rock music. And It still intrigues me. I still listen to it and almost hear, it's almost like I haven't even heard some of the tracks because they're so different over time. It's sort of a monument of a certain moment in the evolution of ambient music, even though it's not really like other music that at that time was marketed as ambient music. And I just want to say, give a shout out in the sense that your 33 and a third book is really quite a wonderful voyage into the record, but also into this whole question of sound, where sound is happening. How do we listen? How do we understand it? And one of the things you do is to track how the music gets used, who picks it up, who responds to it, classical musicians, film soundtrack folks, where does it appear, how does it merge? So it's almost like following the music as it percolates through our soundscape, which is really wonderful. But the question on the dream and the liminality, that's what I want to ask you about.
Oh, certainly.
Now, is about the role that even in Aphex Twin's process and his way of composing and presenting his music had a great deal to do with these sort of liminal states of dream, hypnagogia, the subconscious. So tell me about that.
Yeah, well, what you're referring to is this idea of lucid dreaming, which was quite synonymous with Aphex Twin at the time. I think a certain generation of listeners, of whom I consider myself one, may have first encountered the idea of lucid dreaming as a result of him talking about it in the press. I certainly was not, I don't think I was aware of it at the time. If I was, it was certainly a distant memory. So I came to understand, I think, largely as a result of him talking about it back when he talked to the press more regularly. I had the opportunity to interview him in 1996, and it didn't even come up in conversation, but it was a big part of that record when it came out. And it relates to several things. One of them is just creative process, is this idea that he was supposedly, and you have to be cautious when talking about anything that Aphex Twin says, because he's kind of his own culture jammer. He's made lots of myths about himself for fun and then seen them carried through into the press. And but I have it from several sources whom I interviewed for the book that they witnessed this idea that he would be in a sort of nap-like state where he would be able to think about music in a way that he couldn't actually achieve technologically, and then he would try to achieve it having first experienced it in his mind. And that dream state and that creative space is, I think, in many ways just a metaphoric one for the way that lots of people create art and the fact that they are tapping into something they're not fully conscious of. You know, a lot of novelists talk about this same state where they're not fully in control of the story. They're coaxing it. They're kind of pushing the thing forward and seeing where they go. And that's something that some readers have difficulty with because they think, well, what do you mean you don't make a decision as to where the character goes? But the characters do take on a life of their own. But removed from narrative, the idea of music going in that direction and removed, I mean, there's no verse, chorus, or verse on the entire album. The idea that the music just goes where his imagination took him is a very dreamlike state. And I think that the method that he described coincides with the result of the sound.
Let me ask you this. Do you feel like did he describe any clear audience? Like, was it that he received the sound that the music was going to go into? Or do you feel like it was more like he created it as a result of being in that state? Or was it like a little bit of both? You know what
that's
I mean?
Good. That's a good question. The composer Morton Sabotnick, he's talked about experiencing in a dream a type of music that he himself did not feel responsible for, that it's something he's been striving for ever since to achieve. And I interviewed him last year, and he thinks he's very close to achieving this music he heard back in the 50s or 60s in his head.
Huh.
My experience with Aphex Twin is that, my understanding was that it's much more a matter that he was sort of, part of the beauty of the dream state of lucid dreaming is that you actually can control it. That it
right.
is that you actually are actually manipulating the sound in real time, but in a way that you could never imagine doing when you were just fully conscious.
So my understanding was that he would like lucid dream, nap, he'd go into a lucid dream state, he would compose music in the lucid dream state, little mm-hmm. fragments, bits, and then he'd pop out and he would like manifest it in our reality as well, which is it's an amazing, you know, as a process, it's great. But what's interesting is because it really does sort of shape and frame your sense of this, you know, very unusual, very haunting, and also this very strange music. So it does seem to be particularly, kind of germane to the music that we do hear. But when you think about all the kind of music that was marketed as ambient at the time, or electronic music, or even contemporary classical or more highbrow electronic things that were happening at that time, what stands out as in this record in terms of, well, its uniqueness?
What stands out to me is how much What does stand out about it? That's a very big question. I think that I think what really stands out to me about it is how much it's gotten better with time. A lot of records we talk about being dated, and I think one of the things that's remarkable about the record is that while you can certainly taste the moment that it was recorded during, because culture has so much caught up with it, it now is a much more it's a much more approachable record than it was at the time. I remember listening to it, and part of this is to do with format, was hearing it on vinyl and having to walk across the room and figuring out which track it was and remembering which side you're playing. You really got lost in it very easily. But now that, you know, composers like Cliff Martinez and Clint Mansell and Lisa Gerrard and all these other musicians have filled all the biggest movie theaters with exactly this sort of sound, and television's rich with it, and gadgets and iOS apps, that we're surrounded by this sort of ambient sound, and we've become as a culture more used to it. And as a result, the music is now more familiar. Now, some things get sort of supplanted by that which you can walk people to the promised land that you can't enter yourself. I think one of the evidences of the strength of this record is that it hasn't been supplanted by that which it gave birth to. That in fact, it's actually a richer and stronger album today, even than it was when it was released.
That's really interesting. One of the things you explore in there that I'd love to hear you talk about a little bit is what a beat is, because one of the ways of talking about this record is, oh, it's an ambient record. The songs, they drift along. They're like clouds. It's atmospheric. There's no beats. And what you're really saying is that actually, if you listen closely, some cuts in obvious ways, some in less obvious ways, there's actually rhythm throughout. But this kind of opens up for you into this question that, in some ways, it's a really fundamental question of, like, what is a beat, especially when you're thinking about this kind of ambient, when you're thinking about ambient music or sort of atmospheric music.
Yeah, it's exciting to me that particular section of the book has gotten a lot of, that's the section I keep hearing about from people in interviews and in reviews and just comments online and conversation. So just for someone who's not familiar with it, the record was, upon its release, repeatedly referred to as beatless, and this became shorthand for it. And what I'm write about in the book is, first I do a kind of literature review of what was written about it at the time, including things I myself wrote, and I'm just as guilty as it were as anything. But what I'm not setting out to do is to criticize individuals who called it beatless, because I think at the time it did feel beatless. What I'm intrigued by is how over time, in part because of this idea of the culture coming to the fore that I mentioned earlier, what seemed beatless at the time is no longer beatless. And so I explore not why they were quote-unquote wrong, these critics who call it beatless, but what maybe they meant by beatless. And part of what was going on is that the music was so remote relative to pop music at the time that meant that it didn't seem to have form, even if it did. Also at the time, music criticism was very different 20 years ago because the music wasn't readily available. Most people first experienced music through the written word. You didn't know what a record sounded like till you read the review, and then you could track it down and listen to it, because so little music was on radio, and if there was no such thing as YouTube, it would have the full album for streaming. So this word then framed people's understanding of it, and in the book I even find evidence that was part of a kind of propaganda campaign on the part of the record label itself, that they really triumphed its beatlessness. But then I wonder what they mean by beatless, and part of what I concluded is that what's really lacking in the book is that more of a meta, in the record, is more of a meta beat. Is the whole lack of song structure is very alarming to people, and I think people even maybe felt threatened by it. Because one of the things that's intriguing is that people who loved it and disliked the record both use this term to describe it.
Yeah, that's interesting. But it also seems to me that one of the elements of the record that stays with me and why it does still sound fresh is because it's so extraordinarily specific and nuanced in its timbre. And timbre is a word I want you to unpack for us, because you're good at this music description stuff. But it's also one of those elements of listening and a sound and of music that is not part of our sort of pop education in how to listen to music. We know what melody is. We know what rhythm is. We know what, a four to the floor is. We know what a polyrhythm is, maybe. But most people don't really know what you mean when you say timbre, and a record like this is all about timbre. So
yeah, that color, Yeah, please. I'm so glad that that's a word that you're touching on. But the timbre is the color of the sound. The risk of venturing into synesthesia. It's all the properties apart from the instrumentation, the note value, and the attack, and all that sort of stuff. All that formal descriptive language from the physics of sound removed. Timbre is the kind of aesthetic quality at that moment. And one of my original experiences of wondering about timbre was I was really intrigued by the music of people like Scott Johnson and Steve Reich and Philip Glass. And early on, I would find their scores, and Ligeti's another example, and I'd look for the notation to how they described what was in there. And I discovered that, oh, wow, frequently it would just say guitar or electric guitar. No description as to which electric guitar, as if Pat Metheny and, Slash were going to bring the same tone. Tone and timbre are very closely related, and so I'm really intrigued by the way that timbre is itself a compositional element. And one of the beautiful things about listening to this record now for 20 years straight, we just passed its 20th anniversary, is that all of the material that was made now has this sense of composition. At the time, maybe it was just in free form, but all the slight, subtle variations of the course of these very static tracks come to take on the sense of authorial intent and compositional intent. And you can hear these shifts in timbre as a compositional element, right along with note value and pace and beat per second and all this sort of stuff. It's a gorgeous aspect that I agree is under-referenced, and it's great to focus on it.
Yeah, so and one of the things you're saying is that he's really a composer with this record, and that also points to this other kind of question, or it's actually a whole other, big thing, and we're only, we got 10 minutes left here, but just how what we think of as classical music or as composed music is itself radically transforming these days and recombining and mutating alongside electronica, experimental music, soundscape music, instrumental music in the sense of it's useful for some purpose. So how is that kind of thing breaking down? What does it mean to be a composer these days?
Yeah, one interesting, just to start off with the word classical, one thing I found very interesting in recent years is to discover how many people who make music don't want to use that word. I've interviewed a number of composers recently who clearly are in the bang on a can realm of this sort of music making, who clearly come out of the academic tradition, maybe themselves are even employed in the academy, but you can look at all their work and realize they've never used the word classical. And finally I started asking these people, hey, do you ever use the word classical? And time and again I'm told, that word just does not work for me. One of the intriguing things for me about the interaction between classical and composition and ambient music is that when you look back at the origins of ambient music, it actually began with a classical impulse. If you look back at least to discrete music, the Brian Eno album, part of the reason that he made that record is because he was listening to harp music, and it was, as is well known, it was played at a very low volume, and one of the speakers was out, and he's intrigued by how this music was transformed by that experience, and he wanted to compose something that had that quality on purpose rather than on accident. But the flip side of that same record is just him reworking material from Pachelbel canon. So the very origins of this music we think of as having maybe at some point merged with classical music actually originated that way, and that coming full circle, I think what's happening now is that we're actually coming to understand that that was how it originated and that these two strands are finally being reunited. That's what I think is going on in classical culture and in contemporary composition today.
Well, and then to sort of take it, in another direction, and I want to let you talk a little bit about how the condition of all of these musicians, kids in their bedrooms, anyone can, buy the gear to make electronic music, and then they're all linked online, and they're on newsgroups, mm-hmm. blah, blah, blah. The whole environment for making music, listening to music has really changed, particularly the deeper you go into the technology, the more interested you are in the technological conditions of it, and those people who are using technology to make it in all sorts of situations. You approach that through this quiet as an opportunity to make music in a different way, to create collective environments for music making that are really quite novel and really speak to the changing conditions of music and technology these days. So I just wanted to let you talk a little bit about one of these processes, one of these sort of scenarios you've helped set up with Disquiet and networking with multiple musicians to create shared projects.
Thanks. I appreciate your touching on that. The work you're referring to is this collective of musicians that come together, very loose-knit, but it's called the Disquiet Junto, the word borrowed from a society that Benjamin Franklin formed in 1727. He formed it as the idea of having a place for mutual improvement. And I like that idea, and when I first did this Disquiet Junto project, which at this point in 2014 has had 116 weekly projects, and over 3,000 tracks uploaded by about 450 musicians. It's quite extensive at this point. But the way it functions is that each week I post a compositional prompt, and musicians from around the world, from Poland to Pittsburgh to Tokyo, they submit responses to it. They have 4 days. I post the project each Thursday, and they have until Monday at 11:59 p.m. wherever they are to do it. And it's been just an incredible experience for me. You know, it's funny, I mentioned the jam earlier and how I really loved this specific aspect. Another British band that meant a lot to me when I was younger was the Kinks, and a big part of what I liked about the Kinks was Ray Davies' fascination with that period of time when there were pianos in living rooms, and the idea of music as a communal experience, and the idea that the quote-unquote amateur musician was something that was to be celebrated. And I'm really intrigued by amateur as a kind of retronym, but the idea that at some point there was a professional musician, so we had to have this horrible word to describe people who weren't professional musicians. But I like to see that there's some space that's really important between there, which is simply people who like to make music. And that's the cohort of musicians who come together on the Disquiet Junto week in, week out, doing entirely different projects each week. We've worked with a classical ensemble that recorded Shostakovich, and we took it and remixed it for them. We did projects where we'd take the polling data from the presidential election and view the lines of Romney and Obama going up and down as a composition. It looks like a piece of sheet music, so we interpret it as a sheet music. We've done pieces where we've used shared samples, where people had to go out into the world and record samples themselves. And each week it's a different prompt that explores what I think of as an idea. I mean, I think we're exploring ideas in sound, and it is really one of the great pleasures of my life to do this week in, week out.
Well, and I just want to underscore the importance fun of being able to create another space of talking about music making that's not professional, but it's also not quote unquote amateur. I mean, it's really remarkable when you start to either learn more about how music used to function in people's lives before recorded music, you know, became so dominant, or if you just sort of look at how people organize their own music making and present it to friends and family and to listeners in small scales, et cetera, the whole model of professionalism, it becomes so dominant that it's hard to kind of think around it. And I remember one thing that you also said to me that that really inspired me along those lines was the idea of listening to music online that was like, not, you're not buying music, you're not downloading it illegally, but there's an extraordinary amount of free music online. And just the idea of listening only to music that's available, presented, given for free, just shifted my head. It's like, oh wait, that, like, the whole way that, like, the idea of buying, consuming music was already organizing my attitude about how I could find music online. And even just that simple prompt, basically, really shifted the way that I thought about music as it's being made today.
That brings me a lot of pleasure because, I mean, at risk of getting all matrix about it, to me it is a sort of weird red pill, blue pill thing. It's just the sheer amount of music online for which there is no immediate commercial pursuit. Though I want to be really clear, a lot of musicians involved in the Junto are professional musicians who release records, who are quite successful at it. There are people who are chief operating officers of musical app developers and so forth. So it's not just, you don't have to sort of write off your career at the door for entry. It's a wide range, and the sheer amount of that, and the fact that the music as it's perceived in the press and in general kind of doesn't quite know what to do with that material right now is really fascinating to me. I try not to worry about it too much. I just try to spend a lot of time there, and I just find it endlessly rewarding.
What do you mean about how the people in the press are trying to think about it? It's confusing to people?
I think that people just don't pay attention to it. I think it's something that I mean, how often in any music publication do you read about anything from this vast world, like just a track that someone uploaded to SoundCloud? Unless there's like an economic impulse behind it, it's not written about. Yeah, we call it art, there's a frequent thing I experience. You know, I write a lot about art as well, and it's a really interesting. Is a really interesting reframing can be useful is that every time you see the term art world, just say art market. There's a lot of people involved with art who really think that unless it's for sale, it isn't art, which is kind of bizarre to me. And I'm not only interested in work that is not commercial, but I certainly am fascinated by this tension. And I don't know, it's very weird when your pleasures make other people uncomfortable.
But they also make open up minds, as I think this conversation has shown. Well, Mark, thanks so much for being with us on Expanding Mind. It was a great conversation.
Thank you so much to both of you for having me. I really, really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you. Mark Wiedenbaum, author of Selected Ambient Work, Volume 2, and check out thisquiet.com. It's really worth the effort. So from me to all you out there, keep your minds open.